seeking help or seeking guidance doesn't mean that you've given up. It means that you choose not to give up. That's why you're going to these people. You're asking them questions. You're expressing what you're experiencing. And then they can give you the guidance. So you actually don't lose by asking help.
Yeah.
You don't lose by not knowing. You're a winner by not knowing.
Hey everyone, welcome back to For Soul's Sake, a podcast in which I aim to give you candid conversations on spirituality and wellness alongside a host of amazing guests. Thank you all so much for tuning in to listen, learn, and grow together. And I'm so, so honored today to be joined by an amazing, amazing guest. Now, you know, I'm committed and fascinated by introducing you to people who can expand your mind, who can help you to heal internally and externally, and give you insight into a life less ordinary. And today's guest, Ian Nene, is a former actor, model, and public figure who is focused on sharing ancient wisdom from the East throughout the heart of London today. Having lived as a monk for over 3 years, Ian has thrown himself deep into the practices of yoga, mantra, and looks to share all of that with us in a dynamic and exciting way. As a fellow bhakti practitioner, I'm thrilled to have him on For Soul's Sake to share his interesting spiritual journey from celeb to monk, as well as the obstacles he overcame to be here with us today. Ian, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. That was a nice intro.
Oh, thanks. I'm trying to write some good stuff to glorify our guests. Thank you so much for being here. Yeah. How's your day been? What you've been up to?
Oh, it's been busy mentally, thinking about things, strategizing things, and trying to, you know, just figure out life, isn't it? We're all going through this interesting journey of quote-unquote self-discovery, and at the same time having to deal with so many demands of the world. So I'm kind of in that whirlwind at the moment.
Yeah, trying to figure out how to be a human being as opposed to a human doing.
Exactly. You know, I remember we were speaking about this earlier, about this concept of being and becoming, and how, you know, the world pushes us to become something great, to become, you know, this person who fits this particular kind of status quo, who is presented in a particular fashion.
Mm.
And we forget to be, just being who I am in the now, and being okay with that, and appreciating the steps that I'm going through in my journey at the present moment. And I'm a victim because I don't focus too much on being. I'm always on becoming.
Wow.
I want to be that great version. And then spaces like this force you to kind of step back and be, you know.
Yeah. This is going to be a good episode. I can already feel it. I can feel it in my bones.
Yeah, I'm gassed.
Tell us your story from moving from Kenya to the UK, from being a student to a monk. Tell me a little bit about that. Tell me the kind of key points at which that life transition happened for you.
Right. Yeah. So acting in the media industry was a big thing for me from a young age.
Mm.
I was first on stage around 9, 10. Where I started
9, 10 years old?
Yeah, between 9 and 10, yeah, when I started doing like performances on stage. And I remember I went to my mom and I told my mom, I want to be an actor. And then she looked at me and she was like, oh, my son, you know, wishes were horses, beggars would ride, because you're not in Hollywood, you're in Nairobi, and the industry is not as big. So she kind of knocked my hopes of getting into the industry at a young age. But then somehow or other, the divine arrangement was there. I was performing once in school. We had a prize giving day, and my mom came for my performance, which was great. And then at the end, some producer just waltzed in and was like, oh, are you Ian's mom? Would like to get him on a show.
Cool.
And then boom, from there it started. I did my first show with a Kenyan online streaming company. And then that grew into this other big show that was what really took my career in one sense to the next level, which I was for like 6.5 years. And then I also did different other projects, different ads and different things. So my childhood kind of was immersed in this world of, after school, I'm learning lines for my script, which I'm going to be performing this weekend. You know, so that was, I never really had like your conventional childhood in one sense.
Did that affect you?
It did. I mean, I used it as a coping mechanism, and I don't tell many people this, but obviously because it's you. I think children, in many ways, what they pick up and they choose to do externally might just be like, oh, that's his talent, that's his skill.
Mm.
But also in a deeper level, there might be something that they're using it to combat with or to deal with, if they're over-obsessing themselves with this one particular thing. So for me, acting was, I over-obsessed on it because it helped me escape my life.
Mm.
Or how I perceived the world. I was going through different things, you know, family issues, and I just didn't have the best coping mechanism. So I thought, if I could get into this role and perform in this role, maybe I don't have time or an opportunity to think about what Ian's life is going through, you know? Mm. And so that became my coping mechanism in many ways. And yeah, I used it to kind of deal with different situations, you know?
I don't think it's just kids. I think as adults we do that.
Exactly. Yeah.
We project into a role so that we don't have to deal with the ludicrous way in which we live our material lives, you know.
We
stick ourselves into responsibility so that we kind of turn away from the fact that we have a finite time.
That's it.
And that finite time has to be used for higher purpose.
Exactly.
But no. Most important right now is that I need to be the best at my job. Mm-hmm. Or I need to be the best mum, dad, etc. It's different roles. And it's almost like our life is a play.
Right.
And yeah, while living that play, we forget the main point or that purpose of that play.
Exactly. So I even lost the purpose of my acting.
That's far.
At a point, because I was just like, what am I doing this for? Wow. I couldn't even tell you, because I was just using it to run away from my reality. But I did it pretty well. I must say, I was a good actor in the sense where I hid my actual reality and what Ian was going on for a long time. I used to be bullied in school as well. So that kind of, you know, helped me kind of cope with all of that, because the same people who bullied me now wanted to be my friends. Wow. So that was a good life lesson. And then when I got to high school, I managed to get myself into my dream high school, which was arts focused. And then I got a scholarship there. It was quite an expensive school, but we kind of pushed for it. That was an interesting story in itself, but for another day. But kind of ended up getting a scholarship. And then from there, my mom was able to, you know, create an opportunity for me to study abroad. And so I got accepted to my University of Kent, which was my second dream uni. So my dream uni was in America, American Academy of Dramatic Arts, which was a big one. But then it was so expensive. So my mom was like, we're not there yet. So go to the UK. The time spent on your degree in the UK will be much cheaper.
Yeah.
So go and experience that. And then I landed in the UK. And you can imagine, I'm in this new country. I'm by myself. I've got a free license to do whatever I want. And I've got a little bit of money in my side, so I kind of just had your first years of uni experience. I went all out, kind of just went crazy and partied like anything. I remember there were days I, you know, would come back and I'd be wondering, what day is it of the week? Is it Tuesday, Wednesday? Do I have lectures today? And till I got an email from the uni saying, okay, you're an international student. You need to be in class at least 70% of the time. Otherwise, we will question your visa stay.
So we've got issues.
Yeah, but I was still partying it up, turning it up. You know, I was kind of in that whirlwind and I could see I was always seeking. A part of me still was always seeking. I was born in a Catholic background, but never really had the answers. But I was always kind of like questioning, like, you know, is there something bigger than all of this? Like, you know, especially after, in one sense, successful career in, you know, for a short period of time, you feel like you've got everything. Mm. You start to question, okay, what more is there to this existence? You know, because you learn a lot from being in the public eye. You learn a lot from that space. So I started questioning, you know, like, why is the world the way it is? But then what made me fully question, and that's when I got in contact with spirituality, was once I flew back home after my first year. I went back home to visit my family. I'd planned all these appearances and shows. I was super excited. Then my mom sits me down and tells me, oh, Ian and I went to hospital and some scans were done and I've been diagnosed with cancer. And my cancer is in stage 4. So it's moved from my breasts to my lungs. So imagine me hearing this, you know, and my mom was like my only rock, you know, at the time. My father figure was not really present. So mom was the only person for me. Wow. So you can imagine all the thoughts going through my head. And that's when I did take a bender. I went a little bit, you know, worse than normal, kind of was intoxicating more. Then I remember I sat in my room and I was crying like anything. And I said, God, if you exist, you explain to me what you're on about, because I just don't get it. Yeah. Tell me the master plan. Exactly. Like, what's going on? Because from my side, I've tried conceptualizing it, but I just might not have the intelligence. I might not get everything correct. So you show me, because, you know, everyone is claiming in all these religious practices or in different groups of spirituality that there's a divine force, a divine power. So I think you're more intelligent enough to give me the information.
Well, that's deep.
Yeah. So I told him that, you know, and I remember I was high as a kite. But I remember that and I was like, what are you doing? What are you on about?
Yeah.
And then in that inquiry, One of my friends, her name is Sita at the moment. Yeah, she kind of went through this spiritual transformation herself and took vows and she's called Sita, but at the time her name was Stephanie.
Okay.
So she posted a beautiful picture of this lady, and I think she was a bhakti yoga practitioner, but at the time I had no clue what that was. And she was based in America, but she looked so happy. You know, she looked so zen, so peaceful. She was in all white. I think she was widowed.
Wow.
And she gave this quote of, you know, nothing makes you happy externally unless your soul is nourished.
Wow.
And I found that really interesting.
Happy from the inside.
Yeah, like happy from the inside, like an internal sense of well-being. And there was like a long explanation, but I didn't really bother reading it.
Yeah.
I messaged her and I was like, hey, I still actually have it on my phone. I was like, I'm trying to be a little bit zen. Could you give me some tips on how I can kind of like, you know, align my chakras and kind of like get myself into a zen space? And then she read my message and immediately responded with, she said, I can't make you zen, but I can give you absolute wisdom.
Wow.
And the first thing you need to appreciate to make this work is that you're more than this body. You're a spiritual being having a human experience. And that hit me because I was like, okay, yeah. At first I was like, whoa, okay. But then I'd taken my mom had just come from chemo, from her chemotherapy session. And obviously her body was finished. You know, she had even had, she had to shave her hair because of the chemotherapy. But she still had the energy and the enthusiasm to crack jokes and be happy in many ways. Or maybe she was doing it for us as well to kind of keep us like, you know, hopeful, right? But, you know, who was having this happiness? Because her body was going through so much suffering. So who was experiencing this happiness? So that really hit me, that there's more to us than this body. And then I was like, yeah, I'd like to hear more. So she invited me to the temple. So we have there's a temple, a bhakti yoga center in Nairobi, known as the HKTC.
Cool.
And so she invited me there. And so I went with all these, you know, list of questions. Why do bad things happen to good people? What's the goal of this life? If God exists, why is he so cruel? And I was ready. Boom, boom, boom. And then when I got there, all these guys, I'm hitting them with all these questions, but they're all looking at me so chilled and relaxed.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, you guys are not fazed by my questions? Like, these are like deep existential questions right now, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but they're so relaxed and they're giving me answers and then they're quoting scriptures. So I was like, wait, this comes from some books? What's going on here? So then they opened for me this wonderful book called the Bhagavad Gita. Mm-hmm. And were just explaining to me different concepts and how it's been explained in this in the Vedic scriptures.
Mm.
And that just hit me like anything.
They were also African-bodied?
Yeah, so these were Africans. Wow. These were, yeah, like Kenyans in Nairobi who also chose to take. So this training center is amazing. What has been done is, because not many people are quite into the concepts of Bhakti Yoga in Kenya, because Kenya is very much either Christianity or Islam, you know, focused.
Mm.
They created this space, which is like an opportunity for people to live a much more simpler life, because life in Nairobi is very fast paced. It's super expensive. So they made it somewhat affordable, but at the same time, they're giving people an opportunity to learn spirituality and learn about connecting with themselves and how to deal with life stresses. It's such an amazing concept.
It's super attractive as well. Like you think about it, that bhakti yoga, that's one of the reasons that I got attracted, was that I saw people of different races.
Right.
It wasn't like, you know, right now we live in an age where social, cultural appropriation and spiritual appropriation is now becoming a thing, that bhakti is open for everyone. The door is open for everyone. That's that's amazing. That these guys, HKTC.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah,
if I ever go to Nairobi, I'm checking that out.
I know, for sure. You'd love it. And yeah, the fact that there were these locals, I mean, there were so many people. We had people from America who were coming to study. But I had people who could relate with me as a Kenyan millennial kind of going through life. And they could sit there and appreciate what I was going through and give me some higher wisdom. I felt so at home, so peaceful with that. So I was attracted. And then they gave me this one book called The Matchless Gift, which is a book that's compiled lectures from one Swami. His name is Prabhupada.
Mm.
And they compiled different aspects of the philosophy of Bhakti Yoga. Prabhupada gives like a summary, basically, that's like easy for anyone to read. And it's a large textbook, 98 pages, so it took me like a day.
Mm.
But I read it and it hit me like anything. And I was like, you know what? I think this has some answers to some of my questions. Maybe I should kind of just check it out a little bit. So I started kind of like going more to the temple. Then my mom started noticing and she was like, oh, you're hanging out with these weirdos, you know, I'm not so sure about it. Then one day I went home after meeting one lady who was there. She was American, actually. I forget her name, but I really want to see her one day and thank her because she gave me all these books. I had like 5-6 books. One was called The Science of Self-Realization. I did get a full copy of the Bhagavad Gita from her. She gave me another book, Perfect Questions, Perfect Answers. Another book called Consciousness, The Missing Link.
All of these books, by the way, we're going to put them in the description so you can check them out.
Yeah, for sure. Powerful books. So she gave me this book, this stack. And then I was so excited, so I'm rushing back home. And then I get to the driveway because I thought my mom wasn't home. So I was like, I can go keep them in my room, safe and sound. Mm. So I get to the driveway and I see both the cars are in the house. So that means mom's home. Mm. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe she's tired because of the chemo. I can just rush upstairs. She won't get to see me. She's probably in her room. Wow. But as soon as I open the door, who was in front of me? Mumsy. Ian, where were you? Right. And I was like, oh. You know, I was chilling with a friend like this, and I'd stuffed all the books underneath my sweater. Then one by one, boom, they started dropping. And she was like, oh, really? Is this what you're doing? You're going secretly to meet these people. Why do you have to be secretive about it? Mm. You know what? Pack your bags, go back to the UK. And she booked for me the next flight and I was off.
Seriously?
Yeah. Because she was like, go back to the UK. You won't find these people there.
Wow.
You know, and then I came to the UK and some or other, there were so many seekers of spirituality even around where I was, in Canterbury, because I was at University of Kent, that's where I was studying. And so I met all these people and then, you know, kind of cultivated that, you know, relationship with them, and then traveled to the different centers because there's different centers around the UK. So I traveled into one of the centers, which was actually like an outreach space, and they were doing like mantra meditation, you know, like mantra music meditation.
Kirtan.
Yeah. And that's when I first saw you, actually.
Was it?
Because that was the thing you were running.
Oh,
yeah,
my
which
God.
Is amazing. So I met you
there. When was this?
This was when, I think 2018. I think 2018.
I've got a clue.
Was when this was. Yeah, way back. I remember that. And so I met you. But I met all these young people who were enthusiastic about spirituality and all that. And then I was like, okay, I think I need to spend my time with this. So after graduating university with my degree, I moved into the temple. Wow. It was the temple then for 3 years. And now I'm just kind of getting out. So
this is a far out story. But one thing that really I wanted to kind of go a little bit deeper into is you seem like a really open, confident spiritualist. And you seem, I mean, I know you as a friend, so I know that, it's not just because the camera's on and the mic is on record. You're always joyful and always excited about spiritual life and open about it and able to explain the nuances. But I want to go a little bit backwards and talk about the relationship with your family and spirituality.
Right, right.
The reason why is because one of the most common questions I get is that my family aren't really so supportive. My family don't appreciate spiritual values, you know, spiritual values of ahimsa, non-violence, and therefore not eating meat.
Yeah.
Values of not intoxicating, not taking substances, etc. You know, friends would sometimes alienate you for not drinking.
Right. Yeah.
And what are the values? Chanting and mantra and meditation and breathing and, you know, things that are in one sense quite alien to normal culture. What would be your advice to someone dealing with friends, family, close ones who clearly are rejecting someone who is trying to be a spiritualist?
Right, right. No, I think that's an important thing because many people go through that.
Yeah.
I made the mistake of being rebellious about it.
How do you
mean? In the beginning, at the start,
yeah.
Where I kind of... Okay, so we can put ourselves in the position of anyone who's having to go through any forms of change.
Mm-hmm.
I think... for anyone, changes might be difficult in many ways, especially when you've understood something in a particular way. Imagine like your morning routine.
Yeah.
You've known your morning routine to be you. So you wake up at this time, you do this and that and those. And anytime when you get out of that, it really does...
It affects you
in one way, shape or form. So for a person who's kind of spiritually seeking, imagine that, you know, how your family have known you has been their day routine, their daily routine. And then all of a sudden you've broken that. You know, and yes, we get so much conviction, you know, we know that actually there's something real here. So it's more on how compassionate we are to allowing them in their change to process it naturally. Because I immediately just hit my mom with, okay, mom, what are we having for dinner? We're having chicken? No, thanks. I'm a vegetarian now. Mm-hmm. You know, guys are going out and they're going to have some drinks. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't do that anymore. I prefer to sit back and do some reading. When a couple weeks before, I was the first one at the club.
Yeah.
You know?
You were the instigator.
Exactly. I was the one orchestrating the parties, right?
Yeah.
So for them, I think it's so difficult for them to process, who's my person becoming? Who's my son become? Mm-hmm. Who's my friend? And is it right? Is it safe for them? Because they're always approaching us from an angle of love. The problem is they might not have a deeper understanding of it. Mm-hmm. And we are giving an overload of so much information so quickly that they don't have time to process it. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, I made that mistake where I was just hitting my family with so many philosophical points, which they're like, gosh, you know, my mom especially, because she was like, I was, you know, changing your diapers. And now you're here trying to criticize my way of life because I did that. I made that mistake of criticizing how she was living her life and giving her that this lifestyle is the best way to do it. But I realized actually, if my approach was a little bit more compassionate and understanding, okay, look, mom, I get where you are. And I understand that my changes have been a little bit crazy. It might seem like a phase. Don't worry. I'm just, you know, learning a few things, taking some time out here and there to focus on some things. Mm-hmm. And I can see they're working for me positively. I'd love your support with it. I feel like if I approached her with that mood, things would have been much better. But I didn't. And I came with this whole, like, you know, contrasting reality that's difficult for her to process because she's known her life in a particular way.
Yeah.
And so far, she's been managing. I mean, she's raised 3 kids. She's done a lot for
she's
her
doing
life.
Right.
Yeah, she's doing pretty good. Yeah. So, you know, for me to be so staunchly against her existence in one sense must be a little bit stabbing for her, considering she loves me to bits. Mm. So, you know, if maybe for us we're going through this transition, probably people did it much better than I did. But if they're a little bit more compassionate, you know, and just like, you know, like with a baby who's like trying to walk and then they fall, you know, you don't like go for the baby like you're useless, you know, you're wrong, but you treat them with compassion, you know, and gradually they get the ropes of it and they appreciate you. And now, ever since I started doing that, my family are like my number one rooters. Like, wow. My mom's pretty supportive of me, obviously to the extent with which she can be, right? Yeah, it's amazing. And you know, she's rooting for me. She asks me, how are you doing, how's your meditation going, even though she doesn't understand much about it.
Sure.
But she, wherever she feels she can support, she is. Mm. And she doesn't feel like she's lost her son, because there was that fear of, I'm losing my son to something I don't know.
Right.
Or I'm, you know, and that was the theme around my family, that they felt that they were losing me. But up until I got to assure them that, you know,
Because we're going through moments of discussing existential questions, mm-hmm. or an existential crisis per se, doesn't mean we need to force that experience on others.
That's it.
You know, it's so important that we let people experience spirituality based on where they're at, as opposed to who we want them to be.
That's it.
You know, we want to force them through a door that we're going through, but mm-hmm. they may not fit right now through that door.
No,
and I think you said it perfectly, that dealing with people with compassion, dealing with people with understanding where they're at, as opposed to where I want them to be and dragging them along.
Right.
You know, and I think change is hard.
It is.
You know, when we see someone who we're even close with, even in our spiritual communities, that's going through a transformation of thought, you know, for example, I sometimes have to deal with people not accepting chanting as the only way, even though that's my life.
Yeah.
And imagine I have to deal with people who have to perhaps explore their spirituality in different ways than I did. Mm-hmm. And being able to accept that and love them all the same, even though they're not practicing the same way that I practice my spirituality, is both reforming, it's maturing for me, it's helping me to grow as a person and to see the world in a new light.
For sure. Know? And I like that actually about, like, I've been to one of your, you know, programs and just seeing a wide, diverse group of individuals from different backgrounds and spending time with them, you also realize that they have different trains of thought, different, you know, philosophies that they live by, but then they can all come together and connect on something in a unified force is what makes it amazing, you know? And so, yeah, we can get caught up with, okay, you need to reason like I am reasoning. And if you're not reasoning like I'm reasoning, but this world would be boring if we all thought the same, don't you think?
Totally,
like,
totally.
It would suck.
Yeah, it would be boring.
I wouldn't want a world like that, you know? Yeah, so, you know, that's what spirituality opens for. It's a house where everyone can live in and can evolve their being. you know, their being and understanding themselves in a much deeper way. So
yeah, I love that, that you said a house in which everyone can live.
Live in, yeah.
And I think for those of us who are teachers, you know, I know some of you listening will be yoga teachers, meditation teachers, or even just practitioners at a high level that really, really appreciate the practices, that this principle of can we build a house in which everyone can live. And yes, every door is going to be different. Every community, every clique is going to be different. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if we can connect on some basic principles, it doesn't even have to be the practice has to be identical.
Yeah.
See, there's two things. One is principle and the other is detail.
Detail, yeah.
And the detail may be different. The nuance may be different. But the principles, I think we're all aiming, especially in spiritual circles, you know, I think people are aiming for the same kind of goal point.
That's it, yeah.
Whether it be loving God or treating others with love and compassion, being someone that's trying to be free from ego. And, you know, these are all buzzwords that I think everyone that's listened to this will connect with.
Yeah, for sure.
Still appreciating people based on their deep. So they may dress differently. They may have a different hairstyle than you. Some of them may have beards. Some of them may not have beards, you know. So it's appreciating people regardless of their detail.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, speaking on the hairstyle, because I'm at a process of growing my hair out.
Oh, okay.
So I could get, because I used to have locks before. And yeah. So I want to get locks again.
Do it.
And then just show that actually this, you know, this universal spirituality in one sense really does work for everyone. You know. You don't all have to be monks living in the temple like, you know, like I did, like I had that experience, but from there can you grab and then utilize to transform your life like that? So
yeah,
you know,
beautiful. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the locks.
Yeah, and I'm excited. I can't wait.
How long do they take to grow?
No, it's gonna take a while, but I'm gonna use a cheeky method.
Okay.
I'm gonna skip the ugly phase and get extensions.
Oh, okay.
And then let that grow out. Then okay. Yeah.
I had a picture of myself, because I somehow always picture myself when people talk about these kinds of appearance differences. I'm like, I wonder what I'd look like with like an earring. But when I'm imagining myself with extensions, dreadlock extensions, I mean, people can comment on this podcast, tell me, should I do it, should I not do it? But personally, I think I'm going to stay clear of that.
No, I think you should. Yeah, no, I think you look okay like this. I don't know how I'd imagine you with lock extensions.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, no, we're not going to do that. A question around, okay, we spoke about the principle of a house in which everyone can live in.
Mm-hmm.
We spoke about accepting people for who they are as opposed to who we want them to be. Now, what about when it comes to, we live in an age where spirituality is seen as something that's, I feel like I do, so therefore I should practice, as opposed to having some sort of structure, some rules and regs.
You're right.
Or we live in an age where liberal spirituality is where what people think of spirituality, this liberal, like, do what you want when you want. Don't be anti-establishment. That's what people think of spirituality. I mean, thinking wrongly.
No, you're right.
But yeah, people think spirituality is mostly a woo-woo thing that you just do it when you feel like
it. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But we both come from a background where spirituality does have some kind of framework.
Right.
There are some details, perhaps. Like, for example, practicing everyday chanting or practicing everyday reading. And the question I had was to get your perspective on where someone who wants to start practicing, where would they start? Because, maybe you don't think they should have a practice. Maybe you don't think they should have a framework. Maybe, yeah, it should be just a feeling and, you know, only on that impulse you should practice. What do you think?
I mean, yeah, personally, I wouldn't just rely solely on feeling, because feelings change.
Why?
Right. You know, they change. Like, I remember there was a time when I would, you know, rely on just my emotions. But then my emotions today would be one way.
Yeah.
And then literally 20 minutes later, it's like, gosh, is that the same person? Is that coming from, you know, one sage describes our mind like a monkey. But not just any monkey, a drunk monkey bitten by a snake and haunted by a ghost. What the hell would that monkey do next, right? And our emotions, our mind is like that. You know, it's always like fluctuating, like world market prices. One time it's here, then the next time it's like... So I wouldn't solely rely on our feeling. Feeling is important for sure, but I wouldn't solely rely on that. Anything that I've noticed that's great in this world has had some structure, has had some form of, you know, intent formalization in one sense.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, be it in business, be it in, no one just didn't have in one sense a game plan of like, okay, I might try this and structure something.
Yeah.
It something like that is needed.
Yeah.
And then that can also distinguish the real from the fake in one sense. So those who are actually, you know, experiencing what they should experience and going deeper with it. Uh-huh. And those who are just experiencing and, you know, don't have much knowledge of it, but they're just giving words that kind of can guide people, but not really giving people something authentic.
Substance.
Yeah. So, you know, I break the word spirituality into three words.
Here we go.
Right? Understanding that you're a spiritual being. So from the word spirituality, and then using certain rituals, transforming your reality. So spirit, ritual, wow. Reality. So the ritual aspect has to be there and it has to come from somewhere authentic and it has to have some deep knowledge. Anything to do with meditation, yoga, or spirituality does have authentic sources. Nothing that we're practicing is coming from, you know, my own woo-woo misconception or, you know, who am I to lead a generation of spiritualists with my own knowledge?
Right.
I don't have much of it, but from these sources, these scriptures or these, you know, like from the Vedic scriptures, for example, it's tried and tested for days, you know, many diverse individuals from all over the world have taken advantage of them, have practiced them, and they're all giving us the same information. So I think that's the best place to start with, you know, and then maybe from there, once you've gotten those basic principles, as you mentioned, regulations and all these things, once you've gotten them on hand and can manage them, then you can carve out how your application of these principles works for you.
Wow.
In your nature. I think that makes much better sense. Rather than ignoring that and just working with your own sentimentality, work with a structure, and then from there find yourself through it, you know.
Because we both had a background where I wasn't born in a spiritual family, nor did I kind of see it as innate in my early years, and we both had experiences with substances, alcohol, etc. And I think that what turns away a lot of people from even taking up a practice is saying, oh no, now I'm more spiritual, therefore I won't be accepted if I you know, I'm still drinking.
Yeah.
I won't be accepted if I'm still eating meat. I won't be accepted if I'm, you know, I don't know, sleeping with a million people a week, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that look, if we can appreciate the ideals, even if they are lofty, you know, I can appreciate that. Like now that I'm practicing you know, my form of spirituality through bhakti yoga, I can appreciate if someone says, Radhika, it's hard, like, for me to give up eating meat, or it's hard for me to stop smoking.
Yeah, for sure.
Does that mean I cannot now consider myself a spiritualist? I think we need to become more accepting of
no, defo.
You know, the difficulties of reforming habits.
That's
and, you know, even if you are going to do all the things that aren't recommended in the Vedic scriptures, then fine, aspire for them at the very least. Have a desire that one day I want to overcome them, not for the sake of having overcome them, not for that own sake, but rather for seeing that by overcoming these habits, I may be able to purify my mind and consciousness to connect deeper with God.
No, for sure. And I think I was very fortunate that I had that.
Right.
That I didn't have people who were pushing me to just reform,
amazing,
reform. But they gave me this idea, this standard, and they gave me the motivation to feel that I can actually attain it.
Mm-hmm.
Because many a times, okay, you tell people, okay, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this. And immediately what's going through their mind is every time they do it. And then it's like, okay. You know what? I don't think this one's going to work out for me. Thank you very much. I appreciate everything.
Keep your practice yourself, man.
Yeah, you know, I'm just going to go back and figure it all out. But I remember for me, like even with clubbing. So I used to go out to the club. I loved going out to the club. And a couple of shots does make a difference if you're on the dance floor.
Of course.
You know, you kind of are a little bit more loose, flexible. I don't need it anymore. But at the time it was, you know, essential.
I've seen you dance recently. You don't need it.
Yeah, but at that time I was quite rigid and timid.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was reading these books that were encouraging, you know, and actually how the books really framed it was quite beautiful, because it didn't say give up intoxication, but it kind of was encouraging live a life of purity, and intoxicating your body will be something of the past.
Wow.
So I was like, that's really sick. Okay, so you're telling me not to give up this, but to add this, and then naturally this will kind of give itself up, you know, because I wouldn't want to like fight myself, because that's angry. And so I'd gone out to the club with my mates, and you know, I was at the deck, you know, as always, you know, hyping up the DJ. And then I had this moment of like, actually, I don't think I need this anymore. I've been there, done that. I've heard the exact same drop. The DJ's done the exact same. Yeah, it's DJ so-and-so, you know. And so I don't need it. And so I saw actually by engaging with spirituality in an authentic, sincere way, these things that were being shunned upon in one sense naturally started to disintegrate. So me wanting a life of purity kind of came by itself, you know. Yeah. And then I didn't really force myself to not have a drink. I just didn't buy another bottle next time, you know.
Lose the taste.
Yeah, the taste kind of goes because you're getting something higher, you know. So, yeah, we need to be, you know, compassionate with people who are going through those struggles at the beginning, right?
And even compassionate with ourselves. I think sometimes, you know, those of us who are trying and aspiring for a deeper connection with God, with a divine truth, I think sometimes we can practice out of guilt.
Right.
That I'm practicing my sadhana, my daily practice, whatever that may be for each of you. I'm practicing that because I feel like I owe it to X person, or I owe it to X establishment. I owe it to my teacher. And that guilt trip practice, it's not sustainable in the long term.
It isn't.
It needs to be taste-based.
Right.
You know, it needs to be like, I really enjoy X practice, and therefore, I'm going to get on the mat today. I'm going to get on the yoga mat. You know, people say the hardest thing about yoga is getting on the mat. And so even with chanting, the hardest thing is to pick up your mala and to chant on the beads. And so, you know, if I can just build my taste somehow, by associating, by spending time with people who have that taste,
that's it.
Then it's less guilt trippy practice.
100%.
You know, and I think that we need to move towards that.
Yeah.
Let's move towards gaining taste as opposed to practicing out of guilt.
That's it. Yeah, because that doesn't work.
No,
that
it's not sustainable.
Yeah, I remember, you know, from my past, you know, you're being told, okay, you know, you focus on God like this, but if you don't, you're doomed.
Mm-mm.
Hellfire, you know?
Hellfire,
yeah, I start seeing how many bottles of water you can hold in that hell heat, and I'm like, I don't think that's enthusing me, you know? But yeah, once I just got this encouragement of, you know, starting from where you're at and going through this journey, like the Gita says, or the Bhagavad Gita, there's this beautiful verse which says that this process is joyfully and blissfully performed.
Mm.
And I was always thinking, okay, but why am I not seeing some of these people joyful and blissful?
Yeah.
And I could see because they're putting this extra pressure on themselves to become something rather than be, you know, comes back that being and becoming, rather than accepting where they're at right now and being okay with it. Like, this is where I'm at. I've got this desire. So you know what? Divine energy, if you've got the ability, fix it, because I'm going to work with it right now. What to do? I'm only human, you know? And having that real, sincere, authentic approach to spirituality, then it's fun.
Yeah.
Even through the difficulties. Like, I can share a bit. I'm going through a bit of difficulty at the moment in my life, just trying to get more situated and figure stuff out. Transition's always difficult. But I still get the bliss of spirituality even whilst that's going
regardless.
On. You know? Even whilst my material situation is like, oh my God, and some days I'm super stressed. I, you know, have my depression moments where I'm just like sat alone. The process of identifying that and uncovering it and noticing my patterns and trying to aspire to fix them is amazing, and that is blissful. And
wow.
People need to experience it like that rather than a fear-based approach, because that doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, you're reminding me of a story. There was once a Sufi lady, get this, and she was carrying two buckets through a market. One bucket contained water and the other bucket contained fire. And a person was just walking past and said, what are you doing? Like, why do you have these two buckets? And she said, one bucket, the water bucket, is to extinguish the flames of hell. Mm-hmm. And the other bucket, the bucket of fire, is to burn up the heavens. And the man was perplexed. He was like, okay, I get the hell thing, but why do you want to burn up the heavens? Like, what's that about? Like, why do you want to do that?
Yeah.
And she said, I want to teach people that you don't love God through the suffering of hell, nor do you love God through attaining heaven. You can love God right here, right now, just by being in that moment. And I think that sometimes we can forget how easy it is to tune in, that we see ourselves only as, only if I've done X amount of practice can I tune into that wavelength of God, or only if I've done, you know, this many rituals in my life, if I've chanted this many names of God, therefore I'll reach God, or, you know, if I, or on the flip side, you know, if I just suffer the reactions of my karma, you know, if I just suffer the whatever I need to suffer, then one day I'll reach. In either situation, whether you're in the left hand or in the right hand of divinity, it's easy just to tune in, just to kind of be. I think the tagline for this podcast is be a human being, not a human becoming.
That's it. That's it.
Forget about becoming.
Yeah.
Tune into how can you be in this moment here and now.
This moment, yeah, no, for sure. And that's a really, really an important thing. Just, and divinity is available right now.
Fully.
God's available right now. Yeah. You know, it doesn't matter where we're from, what we've got, what's in our situation. The availability to connect with spiritual reality is there for everyone right now, you know, and that's why I appreciate what you're doing, actually. It's really cool because then people can get this motivation to feel like I can do this right now rather than...
I appreciate everything you're doing. I saw you and a group of students the other day and I was just like completely mesmerized by how they were all captured by every word that was coming out of your mouth. And I was like, this is so beautiful just to see how you're using your charisma for higher purpose.
Yeah.
So I'm deeply honored to be here with you. Thank you so much. I want to ask you one last question before we go into quick fire round, which I'm super, super, super excited about.
All right.
You're a very confident person. I'd say you're like one of Bhakti Yoga's most confident people, if I could say something like that. You bring it out in me. I feel a lot more at ease in this conversation as well. What about doubts? Do you have doubts on the path? Do you have, what's perhaps your biggest doubt at a present moment? And how are you dealing with that? Let's try and see in positive light as well.
Right. No, for sure. Yeah, doubts will always be there. Or at least for me, I've always been there.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think anyone ever treads onto new land without worry or without uncertainty. I feel like in any situation, that's always going to exist. I do get doubts on a regular basis. The difference is what I do with the doubt. So I've noticed the times when I've got doubt and I'm not addressing it, I'm not bringing it to light so that I can get it either extinguished or clarified. I harbor all these. It kind of creates like this spider diagram within my psyche of reasons that support my doubt. And then I get into this whirlwind of criticism and judgment. You know, be it if I see, okay, you know, some of the things that we're running are maybe organizational based and structures and systems have to be there. And in one sense, they're kind of necessary evils. They need to be there, but we could also probably try our best to do without them. And then you see so many things. So when a doubt comes, if I just don't address it or bring it out, then I find it becomes like a parasite that kind of eats into me more and makes me become an offensive individual in the sense that I look at people and I'm judging them or I'm judging a system or I'm judging the scriptures and stuff like that. But I think the way this Bhakti Yoga process works, which is nice, is that you've got these relationships with individuals that probes you to bring out your doubts, you know, and it kind of forces you to sincerely bring out your doubts so that, you know, someone can clarify them for you and give you clarity and make you understand, okay, where this might be. And then if the doubt's not resolved, then they can look for something else. But it creates a platform where you can problem solve whatever disturbances are coming within. And so I've been very fortunate that, you know, I've got people who I go to and I'm like, okay, dude, I read this and it's not making sense to me. So I need you to clarify it for me. Otherwise, I'm not going to live my life based on what that just says. And then they give me the, because it's kind of like a zip file. Spirituality is kind of like a zip file.
A compressed file.
Yeah, exactly. So you open one document and then within it, there's so many different layers.
Yeah.
And so at times you can get caught up on one thing and with our own limited mind draw up so many other conclusions. But if we open up to individuals, especially those who are confident about the process, those who've studied, who've put their time and their work. I'm not a reader. Like, I don't like to read. I've really struggled with it for a long time. So I like to hear from cool people who read and then I hear from them, and that's what makes it easy for me. Because we've got these kind of individuals, then it makes it easy, you know, for us to kind of extinguish these doubts, because it's kind of like a fire that will burn up any confidence that you have on the process. Because at times things might not go so well, and then you start to say, okay, maybe this doesn't work, or you know, or you know, maybe you called out to God in this particular situation and then you didn't see God's hand actively responding, so you say, all right, he doesn't exist, it doesn't work. You become transactional with the divine energy. But I think if you have people you can open up to, you know, just tell them as you feel it, you know, and not having to, like, you know, hide it. Just be honest. This is what I feel, dude. Help me right now.
Totally.
And it does work.
Faith comes from honeybees. You know, how do you get honey out of a lotus flower? You can either take the lotus flower and try and get a pestle and mortar and try and grind it up yourself and try and get the honey out that way, the nectar out that way, or you go and find bees nearby. They know how to extract the honey. Know how to extract the nectar from the lotus flower, right? So just associate with those who already have faith, those who know how to understand the nuances of scripture, the rules and regs, the rituals and why they're there. Just hang out with honeybees, you know, become a honeybee.
Right. You know, that makes me think about something which I think is also important to share. Like, it's so good in one, okay, we shy away from this, but it's so good to say, I don't know.
Right, fully.
It's okay to say, I don't know. I don't have the answers. Mm. I can come to you to give me the answers. Because people don't like to say they don't know.
No.
One time I was at a program and I knew many people who were there were new. So then I asked, how many people are hearing this for the first time? No one puts their hands up because no one wants to look like they don't know.
Right.
You know, but seeking help or seeking guidance doesn't mean that you've given up. It means that you choose not to give up. That's why you're going to these people. You're asking them questions. You're expressing what you're experiencing. And then they can give you the guidance. So you actually don't lose by asking help.
Yeah.
You don't lose by not knowing. You're a winner by not knowing, because then you learn, right?
Especially around friends and family, you know?
Like
in my immature state of, you know, when I first came to a path that was less ordinary, let's call it, I remember trying to make up answers simply to impress and convince the people that were closest to me.
Mm.
And if I had just been a little bit more honest and said, you know what, I don't know, but I do know people that do.
Mm.
Or if I just, just been honest just for the sake of integrity, I think I could have convinced people a lot faster.
For sure.
About my practice and why I was taking to a practice that is no longer materially based.
Definitely.
I think, it's so important. Even as a spiritualist now I'm, 15 years into my practice, there's so many things I still don't understand.
Mm.
And I think that it's more, I think this is something for teachers who are listening to this. It's okay to say you don't know,
right?
You know? But to also still know that there are people that do, and pointing people in that direction.
Direction, that's it. No, 100%.
It's yeah.
That's it.
Should we go into some quick fire?
Let's go for it.
Let's do it. Already. By the way, I've really enjoyed this.
Yeah, no, I love this. This is amazing.
This has been really cool.
You need to get me here. You know,
I mean, we're doing it again.
Yeah,
we're doing this more regularly. 100%. Even if people don't want to. It's
it
happening
is
for me. quick fire round. Okay. Question number one. Deep breath. Okay. Question number one. Best advice you've ever received. Oh yeah, by the way, these are one word, one sentence answers.
You're not the main character in everyone's movie.
Oh. I want to hear more now. Okay, you're not the main character in everyone's movie. Anyone that's listened to that, please drop me some comments on what you thought that meant. Worst advice you've ever received?
Worst advice, wow. What's the worst advice I've ever received?
I don't know.
The answers will... You've got it covered. By yourself, you've got it covered. One person gave me that answer.
Wow.
And that was not good because I just trusted myself rather than seeking proper guidance. So that, like, you know, you by yourself, you've got it covered,
that's
I could
like
say.
The most common advice, isn't it?
Right.
Like, you got this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Actually, you don't.
Worst advice. Wow.
Yeah.
Powerful. Something special about your time living in the temple ashram?
I'd say associating with those individuals who've invested their time and energy into presenting spirituality for others, you know, and to teach others. Like my mentor, who is a monk, a traveling monk right now. He's a senior monk, actually.
Keshavaswamy?
Yeah, Keshavaswamy, exactly. Of course, you know.
Mm.
He's invested so much time on me, given me so much advice. And thanks to him, I could say anything I share is really, I'm regurgitating his words 99% of the time. So I could say that was the biggest thing for me whilst being a monk.
Mm. Walking with saints.
Walking with saints.
Oh, beautiful. Something people misunderstand about you. I'm going to repeat that one for the edit.
Mm-hmm.
Next question. Something people misunderstand about you.
That I'm fully an open book. I've got so many layers to me. As you know, some people, but people might think, oh, you know everything about him immediately. But I've got so many things about me that are quite hidden and, you know, so many doors that require opening. You know, multi-layered.
Wow. And last and final one, if you could create one law that the whole world had to follow, what would it be?
One law that the world had to follow.
Yeah.
Mm. I haven't thought about this one, but I think before anyone has a conversation with anyone else, they should exchange a hug. Have a deep hug, and then they can speak. Be it in a conflict or something that needs to be solved, a hug should be there. Because I think that exchange would, you know, make everything flow so smoothly and so nicely. And every time when I exchange a hug with someone, the experience of sharing or communicating is just much more serene and much more positive. So I'd urge everyone, you know, hug it out in any situation, before any conversation, before any, you know, confrontation, give that person a hug.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, then you can crack on. That's what just came at the top of my head.
Wow, that's beautiful. Ian, I'm looking forward to see all the wonderful things that the world is going to bring you and all the wonderful offerings that you're going to bring to the world. And I think you're a really special soul, and I'm deeply honored that you took the time. You've given so much energy in this conversation. You've given so many sutras and one-liners that will really make people think about a life that's ordinary. And I can only say from my heart, thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me and for actually, you know, developing this platform. If it wasn't for you, would I be here? Of course not. So thank you for creating this space and for, you know, making this a topic that people can listen to and get answers that will help them in this age. So
trying. Thank you so much, Ian. Well, guys, thank you so much for tuning in. I really hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. I think this is probably one of the best, if not the best so far. He's dancing in the background, but I'm dancing internally. I'm so, so stoked that we recorded this. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please feel permission, as always, to re-listen to this episode. There's so many bites that I think will really help to give you new insight into a life less ordinary. Comment, tell me what you like, tell me what you didn't like. Give me some feedback on what you think these conversations are doing for you. And most importantly, please kindly share this conversation far and wide. Please share it with all your friends, all your family. Share it on your social media. Share it from your bathroom window. Share it from, I don't know, where else should people share this?
Worldwide, everywhere.
Do it, please. As an offering of love and service to the world, please do share it. Thank you all so much, and see you on the next episode of For Soul's Sake. Namaste.
For soul's sake.